From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the many voices of Tracy Ullman. She co-stars in Robert Altman's new movie, Ready to Wear, and in Woody Allen's latest Bullets Over Broadway. Also today, some lost verses to Noel Coward songs. We talk with Graham Payne about his new memoir, My Life with Noel Coward. Payne performed in Coward musicals and lived with him for close to 30 years. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD featuring newly discovered recordings of Cole Porter singing his own songs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Tracy Ullman. Interviewing her is like interviewing a room full of people. She's constantly slipping in and out of character, and the range of character she does is quite extraordinary. Ullman was a TV star in England when she moved to the States in the early 80s. In 1987, Fox TV launched her sketch comedy series, The Tracy Ullman Show. Her film credits include Plenty, I Love You to Death, Household Saints, and Bullets Over Broadway. She plays the editor of British Vogue in Robert Altman's new film, Ready to Wear, about the French fashion shows that attract the international press. Most of the fashion shows Altman filmed were real. He told his actors to attend the shows in character.
You know, we were sent out with radio mics on us, and first of all, he sent us out first so that the incredible banks of paparazzi could get their photographs, mainly of Sophie Loren and Kim Basinger. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, uncontrolled media. I mean, I've never been to the Oscars, but I hope to. And I better go one day. And I guess they're all on bleachers and stuff, because you Americans, you know, you're like, hey, get back, buddy. This was unbelievable. It was very frightening. So he sent us out first to deal with the paparazzi, and he said, right, now we're going to go out again, and please leave us alone. And it was really weird to be sort of dressed up as the editor of British Vogue, staring at the real editor of British Vogue across from me, you know, on the runway, who was looking very nervous.
What was the difference between how the real editor was behaving and how you were behaving in that role?
None at all, Terry, because I'm a very convincing actress, you see. There was no... Well, this movie is somewhat farcical. It's sort of farcical documentary. Reminds me very much of Nashville. Altman's film on the country, take on the country and Western world.
Now, our listeners, many of them have also just seen you in Bullets Over Broadway. Now, I understand that you had been writing to Woody Allen for a long time, petitioning him to get a part for you in one of his films. What kind of correspondence did you have with him?
None. I wrote him a very dumb, naive letter, I think, back in the middle 80s when I first came to America and I was pregnant, and I used to sit around the house watching terrible sitcoms and thinking, what am I doing in this country? And then my husband said, what do you mean? You know, watch Woody Allen films. There's a wonderful element here. You know, he's such a snob. And I watched Broadway Danny Rose and just thought, wow. And I wrote a letter saying, hello, I'm British and I live in California right now. And would you like Mia to come and get in my jacuzzi and I could come and help you out with one of your films if she's tired? You know, it was like one of those really dumb letters. Never saw it. But I used to petition more his casting director, Juliet Taylor, because Woody's not an easy guy to get to. And Jeffrey Kurland, his costume designer, I met him once for tea, and he very... kindly gave Woody a videotape of myself. And in 1988, I got a message back via Sam Cohen, the legendary agent, Woody's agent, saying, Woody's got a message for you. He says, it's not a matter of if he'll work with you, it's when. And he wants to tell you that he thinks you're funny from the inside. And I was so, Terry, that's a moment in my career. I mean, I was on my car phone at the time because I was in California. I just had to pull the car over and just, you know, let that moment wash over me. I was so proud. And then he didn't call for 5 years. So it worked eventually.
So how did the experience of being in a Woody Allen film compare with your expectations?
It lived up to my expectations. I had a very good experience. I didn't meet him till I was actually in costume, on the set, ready for take one. I didn't meet him. Usually you meet a director, you talk to him on the phone at least and say, what would you like me to do in this film? And you meet them at costume fittings and they check out your wig and everything. And I didn't meet him at all. And I thought, maybe I'm being filmed in isolation by a second unit and I won't actually get to be in the main picture at all. I thought, I'm never going to meet him. So it was a little disconcerting. But it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And
did you hit it off with him when you actually met?
I was very, you know, you give him his, I respect him so much, I gave him his space and didn't try and say, hey, Woody, this is funny, right? You know, I didn't push my luck. I sent him some rabbi cards, which I collect.
What, rabbi cards?
You heard of the rabbi cards?
No.
There's a company in Baltimore that distributes some cards called the Torah Personalities. And, I mean, you know, I guess the kids are collecting them and they flip and swap on the temple steps. And they are pictures of all the rabbis. And they're just extraordinary. They're, you know, they're of these wonderful old rabbis. And I've had the pleasure of passing them on to David Letterman, Mel Brooks, and now Woody Allen. And these guys get a big kick out of it, you know.
Tracy Ullman is my guest, and she co-stars in the new movie Ready to Wear. When you came to America, did you have to study American so that you could do American characters and so that you could caricature Americans?
I guess I came to America, I got married here in 83, and you can't just get off the plane from England and think you can impersonate Americans because mm-hmm. You have to be a part of the culture. And for a couple of years, I was pregnant and I just hung around the house and just watched Leave It to Beaver reruns, like I say, on Broadway, Danny Rose. And Jim Brooks gave me lots of tapes of, you know, Your Show of Shows and Ernie Kovacs, and I sort of, you know, really went on an intense learning course and then felt capable and to, you know, impersonate you all. And I've lived here for 10 years now and I really do feel a part of it, so I don't feel like an intruder anymore.
You had a very funny HBO special, I guess it was about a year ago, maybe a little more, in which you played, I don't know, a whole lot of roles, including the role of like a Midwestern tourist coming to New York.
Oh, that's right. Takes on New York, yeah.
Yeah, and then you were, you know, like a Jewish mother of the bride.
My favorites. I just love Jews equal funny.
Well, how
New York Jews equal funny. I just love these people. I love being people like Fern Rosenthal.
Growing up Catholic in suburban England, suburban London, how did you pick up on what the New York Jewish middle class style was that you picked up in that show, for instance?
I guess I didn't encounter them until I came to New York in the early 80s, and I have a very dear friend called Katie Volk from Baldwin, Long Island, and we went to see Freddie and Betty in Baldwin, and we went to see her parents, you know, and she said, Betty will come to the door, and she'll say, welcome to Baldwin, and she did. She said, welcome to Baldwin, and I just loved them, you know. They were so, after, you know, sometimes British people are so inhibited, and it's so hard to get their true feelings out, and I just love the warmth of the New York Jewish people. They're so upfront, and they impressed me enormously. And I'm a parrot, as you can hear, Terry. I'm a mimic, and as soon as I met Betty, I mean, I was going home that night imitating her, and so there you go. And I just love to portray these people.
Tell me more about New York and California types that you've picked up on.
Well, you know, you do that stereotype. I do my stereotype. I'm working on me 12-step program, California Voice. But there is a lot of that there, you know. First impressions are very important. I like the New Yorkers who are transplanted to L.A. that bitch about the place all the time. I miss the seasons. You know, you're sick of hearing that there. Or they come out and they go, I miss the neighborhood and blah, blah, blah. And after 6 months, they're going, my pool guy did not show. And they're soon into the California. There's such a difference between New Yorkers and Los Angeles. And I'd never really seen the middle of the country, I realized, after I'd lived here a few years. And I asked Fox, who when I did my television show on the Fox Network. I said, you're always sending me to LA and New York, and you talk so disparagingly about the people in middle America. I mean, it's... I always remember Joan Rivers putting one hand on one side and pushing her hands in and saying, dumber, 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 dumber about America till her hands met. And so I said, please, would you send me to Toledo, Ohio, and Nashville, and Tennessee? Please send me to meet the real people. And they did. I did a little tour, and I enjoyed it immensely. And I took Polaroids of people and taped their voices. And I have this special tape I can refer to.
My guest is Tracy Ullman. She co-stars in Robert Altman's new film, Ready to Wear. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tracy Ullman. Now, what were some of the personality types that you picked up on when you were performing in England?
Well, I used to do the same thing in England, really, Terry. I started off as a dancer when I was 16, you know. I'm an old soul. I left school really early and had to get out and make some money. And I used to travel around and take jobs in particular cities because I loved the accents. All the types, really, in England and the types I impersonate in America, too, there's always an analogy. Like, there's the girls in Queens have the same values and expectancies of, like, girls in Manchester. And I find Liverpudlians very akin to New Yorkers.
Could you demonstrate what it is that ties a girl from Manchester?
Like, you know, like the Beatles, they're a bit dead tough like that the whole time, making jokes. And they live in a really hard, tough, cold city. And they're just, like, all jokers and, you know, oh, please. You know? And I find New Yorkers are just the same, you know. Please, honey, don't wear your jewellery in the city. Turn your rings. They're tough people from a tough city with a great sense of humour. Do you know what I'm saying?
Did you grew up in a couple of different places and in a couple of different classes in England.
Yeah, yeah.
Because your father was, I think, very wealthy, but he died when you were six and you kind of dropped down in class and changed neighborhoods afterwards. So did you have different accents when you were young?
Yeah. Yeah, I did jump around, and it's unusual to jump around in England in the class system. Usually you're born into it and that's it. You're stuck. My dad was a Polish immigrant. He came over after the war, so... Tracy, he talked like this, you know, it's very, very different. When he died when I was six, he made a lot of money. And then he died when I was six, and it didn't last long. My mother wasn't really accepted in the Polish community to carry on his business. So there you go, there's a difference. So our fortunes came and went, and I did jump around and... having to be adaptable then, I think that's how I got. Because, as I say, you do get stuck in the British class system, and I never let it inhibit me. My husband is very working class, East End London, and he talks like that, and people have called him a barrow boy, and he gets really angry about it. But I just used to impersonate people. I mean, if I was with posh people in England, I'd just start talking like that, like one of Lady Diana's friends. Or talk like that if I go to the East End, do you know what I mean? And there's not many people that can jump around in the class system like that. And so they got very confused by me, and they don't know where I'm from.
So, but when you changed class,
yeah,
did you change accents as well?
Yeah, I mean, when my father died, up to that point, I'd been driving in Volvos and going to Gymkhana's, and we had ponies and things, and it was really brilliant, and we drank orange squash. And then my father died, and we had to go to, like, a public school, and I got beaten up in the playground, so I started talking a bit like that, you know. I soon adapted. Yeah, absolutely, I did.
Now, you started in acting school, I believe, when you were 12 years old. How did you know at such a young age that you wanted to perform?
I didn't really. It was, it's the class thing again. Here we go back to this. I was at a state, we call them state schools, the public schools in England, till I was 12. And I was very good in the end of term productions. You know, I was always in the school play and I was always writing plays and amusing the other kids and impressing the teachers. And they said to my mother at the end of a particularly successful show, Tracy should go to a special school. I thought, oh, they mean like a remand home type place. So I was very naughty. So my mother thought, wow, you know, let's try and win a scholarship to one of those fancy places in London, and which indeed I did. And thanks to the socialist government of the time, I got a grant, a full scholarship to go to this place. And I thought it was horrible. It was like, you know, like FAME, that School of Performing Arts in FAME.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wasn't like that. We didn't go into brilliant, unrehearsed dance routines in the hallways and stuff. It was just full of, like, really dumpy, fat, ugly kids or pretty ones that whose parents wanted them to be stars. I mean, the whole thing of making kids act is really ugly. You know, it was like kids saying,
well, I've been in a Barbie commercial, so I don't have to study schoolwork because I'm going to be a star.
And I hated it. I hated it. But it was great because, you know, I was going to a school in London and it was like I was in middle class again.
But weren't you expelled when you were 16?
I was, yeah.
What for?
I just wouldn't take all that crap, Terry. I mean, I used to fight the system. I used to say, this is ridiculous. This isn't what show business is about. And the way that the principal of the school had got this school by winning money in like a lottery in England. She had no idea about show business. Her own kids went to the school. They were constantly given work and put up for auditions, and the competitiveness amongst, like, you know, these 8 to 16 year olds was so ugly. And I used to complain about it. And they, you know, and then I just, when I realized it wasn't no good at complaining, I just used to be in my school uniform next door in the pub playing snooker all day. And they just got rid of me. Huh, rebel, huh?
Were you upset when you were expelled?
My mother was, but the next week I just gathered myself together and went off to Berlin.
To perform?
Yeah, as a dancer, to get my union ticket and to get out in the world. And, you know, I think not get too poignant here, girls that lose their fathers at an early age, I think we're pretty tough. I found that when I've met other kids that have lost their fathers, especially girls, you know. You're just more independent and you get out there and, you know, you do stuff. So that's what I did. Went to Berlin as a dancer with 20 other dancers, I think 14 flaming homosexuals in pink platform boots, who were just the most wonderful guys.
So what kind of dancing?
Was it for musical? It was Gigi. It was a production of Gigi in German.
Uh-huh.
So I know Gigi in German. Dank eben für kleine Fee. And I was there for 4 months, and it was an extraordinary experience.
Now, I read something you said, which I wasn't sure whether it was a joke or for real, but you'd said that your mother had wanted you to get a nose job and breast implants when you were younger.
That was a joke.
That was a joke. Okay.
I guess, yeah, that was... No, she's not that type of mom. You know, we're not talking Rose, Mama Rose here. My mother never really pushed me. You know, she liked the fact I went to this stage school, but she wasn't a pushy mom. And she's got a great sense of humor, my mom. And no, that was a joke.
What did you think of your looks when you were first starting out?
I guess that remark stems from the fact that I felt ugly at 12 years old, being put amongst all those kids, professional kids who were in Barbie commercials, and the blondes got the jobs, and the brunettes like me with the slightly suspect noses got pushed aside. And then I thought, oh, God, is this going to matter later in life? And then luckily I saw that it didn't matter. I remember being in a lineup of kids for a revival of Kismet or something in London they were doing, and they lined us up on the stage, 300 children, and a director stood there, stared at us for like 30 seconds, then said, OK, you step forward, and you. And he pointed right at me. And I stepped forward, and he went, no, not you, dear, the little girl with the blonde hair next to you. And you just don't forget things like that, you know. They treat children far worse than they do adults, actually, in this business.
So were you angry that talent was confused with blonde hair or,
yeah,
or a pert nose?
Yeah, I just thought, this is what it's all about, right, looking cute. So,
You've played people of all kinds of looks in your sketches. You've played people who are glamorous. You've played people who are very plain. In fact, in playing people who are very plain, I think, have you, like, padded your tummy a little bit to get, like, a little belly?
Oh, yes, I have all sorts of body padding. I have a wonderful costume lady called Jane Rum, who worked with me on the Tracy Ullman show and just won an Emmy for Takes on New York. And you should see our dressing room. It was amazing. I mean, we had big breast, smaller breast. We had like Jewish hips. We had like Guatemalan stomachs. It sounds very racist, but it's true. You know, if you look at the different groups of people, they do have sometimes distinct physical differences. And she's an expert at it, Jane. And my character Kay, oh, I had the old cellulite legs and bottom, and I had big breasts made out of bird seed. And when we used to be dark on the show for a few months, they used to get stored in a storeroom, and every year we'd come back and Kay's breasts had been eaten by rats. That was always the first thing we did the first day of the new season. New Kay breasts, please. Vermin have attacked them.
Tracy Ullman is my guest, and she co-stars in the new Robert Altman film, Ready to Wear. Do you ever worry that your characterizations will be interpreted as ethnic stereotypes?
No. Not if you give them enough heart. And when I did play a black lady, which was a big thing to do on the show, because, and then everyone said, well, look, Eddie Murphy was a white guy recently, why shouldn't Tracy play a black lady? And I eventually did the piece, and I practiced putting on the prosthetic makeup of the black lady during the week, and I drove home from the makeup studio as a black lady in my Range Rover. I thought, if I get stopped now for speeding or something, I've got this black head and the rest of my body is, you know, white. I thought, oh no, it'll just be very hard to explain. So I stopped off at Jim Brooks's house to show him the makeup, and he wouldn't let me in because he couldn't recognize me. And I finally got in, and he's like, wow, man, wow. And immediately put on a Whitney Houston album. I said, Jim, please, you know, can we have some Aretha Franklin? And then I went home as a black lady, and I just loved it. I mean, to be able to be black for a night. And I was singing, and I was, like, giving my husband a hard time. And eventually I felt like a kid, Terry, because he just said to me, Tracy, that's enough. He was trying to get through to me because I was so into my character. Take the makeup off and go to bed. You're not black, you're Tracy. Please, would you just stop it now? You know. So, when that character went out on the TV, I think a week later I was in Central Park, and a couple of great black guys at the zoo there said, well done, and thanks. You know, it was great you doing that, and it was great fun, and I felt really pleased.
Did you do any of the writing for the Tracy Ullman show?
I never had time to sit in on the writing all the time. Of course, my contribution was in coming up with characters and hopefully doing a sketch so well that it could evolve into something else. And there's a lot of ad-libbing and a lot of general discussion, and it was a group effort a lot of the time. But no, I feel sorry for the writers on a TV show, because when you finish a season, I mean, I can go on vacation, and they just sat there for the next few months writing it again. It's very, very hard.
So would you come up with a character, show it to the writers, and then they'd write a story for that character?
Yeah, they used to wait for me to be in character on a Friday night. And as I say, I would get so absorbed and so carried away. It was almost like talking in tongues. You know, I'd suddenly say, yeah, I'm getting something through now for Summer Storm. Yeah, I guess I have this Hispanic boyfriend, and I have like this German shepherd who's like stinking out the place, and put that in the next script. And yeah, I waited till I was in character to come up with ideas. It's like, write this down.
Do you miss the mania of doing a weekly show with lots and lots of characters now that you're doing more movies?
I don't miss it yet, I must admit, Terry, because it got awfully hard. It was awfully hard. It was terribly rewarding and a wonderful team people to work with, but it was really draining sometimes. I really wanted to have another child as well, and I do. I have a 3-year-old now.
It would be very hard to
do a show like that and give enough to my children, who are really important to me.
Oh.
Isn't that nice to hear? They're really important to me.
Well, Tracy Ullman, I thank you so much for talking with us. It was really just a pleasure.
Oh, it's lovely to talk to you.
Tracy Ullman co-stars in Ready to Wear. It opens Christmas Day. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Hey! Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a couple of lost verses to Noel Coward songs. We talk with Graham Payne about his new memoir, My Life with Noel Coward. Payne performed in Coward musicals and lived with Coward for nearly 30 years. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD featuring recently discovered recordings of Cole Porter singing his own songs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Noel Coward wrote songs that epitomized wit and sophistication. My guest Graham Payne writes about the public and private Noel Coward in the new memoir, My Life with Noel Coward. Payne performed in several of Coward's musicals and lived with him for close to 30 years. Payne's book includes previously unpublished theater essays by Coward and a couple of lyrics that were never publicly performed. Before we meet Graham Payne, let's hear him sing Sail Away, one of Coward's most melancholy songs, which Payne introduced in 1950 in Coward's musical Ace of Clubs.
When the storm clouds are riding through a winter sky, sail away, sail away. When the love light is fading in your sweetheart's eyes, sail away. Sail away. When you feel your song is orchestrated wrong, why should you prolong your stay? When the wind and the weather blow your dream sky high, sail away, sail away.
Graham Payne, welcome to Fresh Air. Sail Away, which we just heard you sing, is a song that you actually introduced in the musical Ace of Clubs. Did Noel Coward give you advice about how to sing Sail Away?
Yes, he said, just do it. You know, don't put in the expression was one of his favorite bits of direction. That the song is good, the lyrics are good, just do it.
In your new book, you include some lyrics that were never performed on stage. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the final verse to Noel Coward's song, Mrs. Worthington. In fact, why don't we hear a little bit of Noel Coward singing the song before we hear the final verse?
Oh, that's a good idea, yes.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. The profession is overcrowded and the struggle's pretty tough. And admitting the fact she's burning to act, that isn't quite enough. She has nice hands to give the wretched girl her due, but don't you think her bust is too developed for her age? I repeat, Mrs. Worthington, sweet Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage.
So that was Noel Coward singing Mrs. Worthington. Graham Payne, would you read for us or recite for us that final verse for the song that was never performed in public?
Right. Starts, don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. One look at her bandy legs should prove she hasn't got a chance. In addition to which, the son of a bitch can neither sing nor dance. She's a vile girl and uglier than mortal sin. One look at her has put me in a tearing, bloody rage. That sufficed, Mrs. Worthington. Christ, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage.
That's really funny. Now, why did Noel Coward not want that final verse performed?
I don't know. Maybe it is the word Christ. Could it be that?
Could be.
Might be.
Do you think he thought it was too rude?
Yes, because he minded about that very much. I mean, he wasn't particularly religious himself, but he minded about other people's feelings.
Now, in your new book, you reprint a chorus to Noel Coward's song Mad About the Boy that was never performed in public. So I'm going to ask you to recite that lost verse. But first, I should say that this was actually written for the character of a dapper businessman in a formal black coat and striped trousers.
Yes, apparently it was, but it was never done in the show. They cut it out.
Right, so this would have been a man singing
Mad About the Boy.
It.
Yeah, that would have been very wrong in those days anyway. I'm mad about the boy. I know it's silly, but I'm mad about the boy. And even Dr. Freud cannot explain those vexing dreams I've had about the boy. When I told my wife, she said, I'd never heard such nonsense in my life. Her lack of sympathy embarrassed me and made me frankly glad about the boy. My doctor can't advise me. He'd help me if he could. 3 times he's tried to psychoanalyze me, but it's just no good. People I employ have the impertinence to call me Myrna Loy. I rise above it, frankly love it, 'cause I'm absolutely mad about the boy.
Do you think Noel Coward would have been comfortable with a public performance of a gay version of Mad About the Boy?
Oh, I think he would have just passed out and done it. You know, he'd have enjoyed himself.
He would have enjoyed it?
I think he would, yes. Oh, yes, he would have taken the trouble to write it. And as he thought it was going to be well done, but then, of course, they wouldn't allow it.
So who cut it from the show?
The producers, whoever they were.
In 1955, Noel Coward wrote in his diaries, "There will be books proving conclusively that I was homosexual and books proving equally conclusively that I was not." And as you write in your book, today it's no secret that Noel Coward was a homosexual, and he was neither proud nor ashamed of that fact. What was at stake for him if he were publicly known to be homosexual?
Well, he wouldn't have liked that because at the period of his life, it was just not on at all, you know. It was not accepted.
It was actually illegal in England.
It was illegal. Indeed it was, yes.
Was there an unspoken code of etiquette where basically everybody knew that he was gay, but no one would officially know it? No one would discuss it publicly?
I don't remember. No, I never heard it discussed at all, I promise you. Never, ever heard it discussed. That is a private thing, and it was never, never talked about.
My guest is Graham Payne, and he's written a new memoir called My Life with Noel Coward. He lived with Noel Coward most of his adult life, and he also sang in several of Noel Coward's musicals. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Graham Payne, author of the new memoir, My Life with Noel Coward. He lived with Noel Coward for many years and also performed in several of Noel Coward's shows. The first Noel Coward show you performed in was Words and Music, a review, when you were 13.
Yes.
Now, how did you get a part at such a young age?
Well, I must tell you, because Charles B. Cochran was a producer and a very sophisticated one at that, and Noel was a very sophisticated writer, so there wasn't much material for a boy soprano in a Coward review. So my mother said to me, in case they stop you at the audition, you sing and dance at the same time. So I sang Nearer My God to Thee and did a tap dance to it. Well, that amused Noel so much. I remember seeing him stand up in the stalls and said, we've got to have that kid in the show.
So how did you stay in touch with Noel Coward after Words and Music closed?
I didn't see him again until the war, when he came to see me when I'd grown up then, and I was in a big successful review called Up and Doing. And he just came backstage to say, you know, how good he thought I was as a juvenile. juvenile lead, you know, that's mm-hmm. the song and dance chap. So, you know, then he came to see the next shows, and all it was years later, it was 1945, that he finally said, 44 it was, going into 45, I want you to be in my next review called Sigh No More. And that's how I was engaged for that. Otherwise, you know, we hadn't seen each other.
And it was during that performance of Sigh No More that you moved in with Noel Coward.
More or less, yes.
How did that come to be?
Well, I don't know. We just became great buddies and great chums, and that was fine. And we had a spare room in his place, and I was getting too big to live with my mother in that little flat that we had. And he said, you come move into my spare room. And I did. And that was it. Then I lived with him forever after that.
Now, Cole Leslie, who became Noel Coward's secretary and also wrote a wonderful book about Noel Coward.
Yes, he certainly did. Very good book indeed.
Yeah, no, he was already living with Coward. And in his book, he said, oh, people would always say, well, aren't you jealous or uncomfortable with Graham Payne moving in? And he said, no, you know, that the two of you liked each other immediately. And you basically say the same thing in your book.
Yes, it was quite true. We just took to each other and became chums. That is it, we were great friends. And remained so right until he died.
So the three of you lived together until...
Yes,
Noel Coward died.
Yeah.
How did your life change after Noel Coward's death?
Well, it was a terrible, terrible shock, as you can imagine. That awful blow of losing such a great friend and such a brilliant one, who was always so witty and funny and make you laugh. That was terrible. But Coley and I took on the business side of it, you know, the estate. And then the terrible thing was when Cole Leslie died, I was left alone to handle the Noel Coward estate. Well, I hadn't done anything like that actually before. So I really had to put my foot down and get to work. And so that's what I do now.
What are some of the typical decisions you have to make now in managing the Noel Coward estate?
Well, it's trying, as best I can with most of them, is to have the say in casting. That's very important. Because some people have mad ideas, they want to do silly things.
Have you ever used your veto power?
Oh, yes, I have. You know, I won't mention who with, but I have said, no, that wouldn't be right at all. I'd want to get somebody else. Like another silly thing that came up, some company somewhere in America, this is, wanted to do an all-male production of Private Lives. But I said, certainly not, in no possible way is that to be done with a normal male cast. It would ruin the play. It's got to be done as it was written, and that's it. And I just stopped it. And then they keep on wanting to do that. Then they want to do Blythe Spirit also. I had to stop that one too.
You've outlived the two people who you've been closest to in your life, Noel Coward and Cole Leslie. Mm. Has it been difficult to continue without them?
Well, no, I've been very lucky, you see. Of course it's difficult, and I miss them personally, but I've been kept so busy handling the estate that I'm busy all the time. You know, it's a seven-day-week job. It'd be terrible to miss great friends like that. And other close friends like Joyce Carey, who was a part of what we called the family, and Lorne Lorraine, they've all gone. It would be terrible. But fortunately, I can survive.
What was the family?
Well, just very close friends.
You never had a real family when you were young, because, I mean, you had your mother, but it was just the two of you, I believe.
No, because she moved away early, you see, and I was farmed out because my father couldn't look after me, and my mother had gone to Germany to study singing. And the poor relations had to take me in, so I was put with one uncle and aunt to live with them, and then my mother came and saw that she didn't like that idea, and I was moved to another uncle and aunt. It didn't go very well either. So I sort of had a very, very strange, early, young childhood of living in other people's houses as the kid that was really just being taken in because he's family, you know.
So it must have really meant a lot to you to become a part of what you describe as the family, the group of close-knit people.
That's right.
Who developed around Noel Coward.
Well, it had never happened to me before, you see. It was absolutely wonderful. I was part of a family. rather late in life, but it was marvellous.
But it's a family that lasted throughout Noel Coward's life.
That's right.
Graham Payne, his new memoir is called My Life with Noel Coward. Coward was a friend of the great American songwriter Cole Porter. In fact, one of Coward's most clever lyrics was a parody of Porter's song, Let's Do It. Here's Noel Coward recorded in Las Vegas in 1955.
Mr. Irving Berlin often emphasizes sin in a charming way. Mr. Coward, we know, wrote a song or two to show sex was here to stay. Richard Rogers, it's true, took a more romantic view of this sly biological urge, but it really was Cole who contrived to make the whole thing merge. He said that Belgians and Greeks do it, nice young men who sell antiques do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Monkeys, whenever you look, do it. Ali Khan and King Farouk, do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Luella Parsons can't quite do it, but she's so highly strung. Marlena might do it, but she looks far too young. Each man out there shooting crap does it. Davy Crockett in that dreadful cap does it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. All famous writers in swarms do it. Somerset and all the moms do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. The Brontes felt that they must do it. Ernest Hemingway could just do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love.
Noel Coward's parody of Cole Porter's Let's Do It. There's a new CD of Cole Porter singing his own songs. We'll have a review in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on planned cutbacks in our train service?
Hi, Terry. Amtrak train cuts announced include service between Milwaukee and Chicago, lots of other reductions, and cutbacks in frequency on especially the Empire Builder from St. Paul out to Seattle and Portland. We'll have that report and a talk with a train historian about these and earlier cuts. David Mopus reports on the plane crash, the American Eagle crash, last night in North Carolina. We'll have a remembrance of Orville Faubus, the former governor of Arkansas who's died at age 84. Ina Jaffe reports on more about the financial worries of Orange County, California. Dean Olscher on jazz education in America.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. American popular song is a favorite of our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz. A never-released recording by one of our great composers is his latest find.
In a poetry class I was teaching last year, I was talking about great American song lyrics. But when I mentioned Cole Porter, there wasn't a flash of recognition. The students had never heard of him or any of his most famous songs. You're the Top, Just One of Those Things, I Get a Kick Out of You. My heart sank. Still, not all is lost, at least not yet. Every now and then, someone like Steve Nelson comes along to remind us of these treasures. Nelson was working on a book about the late Abe Burroughs, writer, director, TV personality, and the father of James Burroughs, the creator of Cheers. Going through Burroughs' files, Nelson discovered a home recording on which Cole Porter was accompanying himself in songs from Can Can, the 1953 musical he was collaborating on with Burroughs. The show turned out to be one of Porter's biggest hits. So now we can hear the composer himself urging us to let ourselves go and do the can-can.
If in Deauville every swell can, it is so simple to do. If Debussy and Ravel can, 'twill be so easy for you. If the Louvre custodian can, if the God Republican can, if Van Gogh and Degas and Cezanne can, baby, you can too. if the chief in
Porter's funny sound is like a mirror of his soul. His incisive sense of rhythm invests standards like I Love Paris and C'est Magnifique with surprising passion. In the show's rollicking anthem, Live and Let Live, his clipped, effete voice takes on the ferocity of a personal battle cry.
Live and let live, be and let be, hear and let hear, see and let see, sing and let sing, dance and let dance. You like Offenbach, I do not. So what, so what, so what? Read and let read, write and let write, love and let love, bite and let bite, live and let live, and remember this line, your business is your business and my business is mine. Live.
Porter sings lyrics that are different from their final versions and several songs that were cut from the show before it opened. The new disc also reissues home recordings that Porter made in 1935 from a flop called Jubilee, which Porter wrote while he and the entire production team were taking a world cruise. The songs here suggest something more like a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta than a Cole Porter musical. Here's the delightful Kling Kling Bird in the Divvy Divvy Tree.
Oh, beware, beware of the ladies fair in the countries across the sea. Better follow the advice of the Kling Kling Bird on the top of the Divvy Divvy Tree. When about to get in a sweet one's nest, make a graceful excuse and flee. Better follow the advice of the Kling Kling Bird on the top of the Divvy Divvy Tree. For it may be fun to belong to someone, but it's wonderful to be free. Better follow the advice of the Kling Kling Bird. Better follow the advice of the Kling Kling Bird on the top of the Divvy Divvy Tree. On the top of the Divvy Divvy Tree.
Jubilee starred the dotty Hollywood comedian Mary Boland. Her son was played by a young actor named Montgomery Clift. Too bad Porter never recorded the two songs from Jubilee that remain in the collective consciousness, Just One of Those Things and Begin the Begin. Nevertheless, if you care about the history of popular songs and the American musical theater, this album has extraordinary value. If you don't, you'll just have to settle for a wonderful time.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Cole Sings Porter, rare and unreleased songs from Can Can and Jubilee on the Koch International label. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Bob Alls, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I am dejected. I am depressed. Yet resurrected and sailing the crest. Why this elation mixed with deflation? What explanation? I am in love. Such conflicting questions ride around in my brain. Should I order cyanide or order champagne? Oh, what is this sudden jolt? I feel like a frightened colt, just hit by a thunderbolt. I am in love.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.